From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunnyvale, California.
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California.
North Oakland.
North Oakland.
North Berkeley.
Coming up, something that many women can relate to, but most may find hard to talk about.
I'm 35 years old, and I buy diapers for myself.
Then we meet a local playwright who refuses to stay silent.
I feel like my voice has to be about the way it feels to be othered as a woman, as a person of color. Like, that's my whole point.
And we'll figure out why your signature is worth so much this election season.
So everybody looked around and thought, oh my God, historically low, we can all qualify. And so what happened was that just flooded the market with petitions.
Advancing the conversation today on Cross Currents. We're starting off by talking about something that happens to many women, but you almost never hear about it: urinary incontinence. It's not just a problem for older adults. Some studies suggest 1 out of 10 women in their 30s experience some kind of bladder control issue. Others say the numbers are much, much higher. Fortunately, there are medical professionals, treatments, and a whole new crop of technologies that can help. Reporter Lauren Whaley tells us all about it.
My, I have to pee-pee in the toilet.
My son is 2, and he has mastered the toilet. He doesn't pee in his pants or wear diapers, but ever since he was born, I do. I'm 35 years old, and I buy diapers for myself.
Talking about incontinence is still one of those frontiers that's not really comfortable for many women to talk about.
That's Dr. Amy Rosenman.
I am a health sciences clinical professor at UCLA in the Department of OBGYN.
Some studies report that 1 out of 10 women my age are peeing themselves. Others say the numbers could be much, much higher. But it's tough to talk about. Peeing in your pants is embarrassing. I want to tell women that they don't have to suffer, that they're not alone. Medical professionals and a whole crop of new technologies can help. So, here's my story. I have what's called stress incontinence. Not from emotional stress, though leaking pee can cause that, but from the physical stress of coughing or jumping or wrestling and laughing with a 2-year-old. No, I'm not going to die from this, but it has changed my life. I stopped running, the activity that makes me sane, because I hated soaking through 2 pads and still coming home with wet shorts. For many women, it's a lot worse.
Severe incontinence, women stop traveling. They're embarrassed about their absorptive products and how they dispose of them, and it's major life-altering.
Urinary incontinence is what's known as a pelvic floor disorder. There are 2 other major ones. There's fecal incontinence, which is leaking poop, and organ prolapse, when the uterus or bladder or intestines actually start to sag and fall into the vagina. About 1/4 of American women have at least 1 pelvic floor disorder, and urinary incontinence is the most common. There are a ton of factors that contribute to leaking, so get ready for a long list. But first, a little more about the pelvic floor. The pelvic floor is a group of muscles in the shape of a basket. It's connected to the abs and cradles the bladder, intestines, and uterus. It helps control pee and poop and helps guide the baby out during childbirth. So, back to that list, the reasons someone might leak pee. For those of us that have had babies, hormonal changes, the weight of the baby during pregnancy, and childbirth injuries can weaken or damage the pelvic floor and cause leaking. Genetics and weaker pelvic muscle tissue can also make you more prone to leaking. Same if you're overweight or if you smoke. For older women, hormonal changes during menopause or just gravity taking over can cause leaking. And in some women, it's not muscular. The communication between brain and bladder breaks down and makes you feel like you gotta go right now. That's called urge incontinence, and it's more common in older women.
After age 60, greater than 30% of all women have some form of incontinence.
And after age 80, about 1/2 of American women leak pee. Lucky for us, younger and older, there's now an entire subspecialty in medicine built around treating pelvic floor issues. It's called urogynecology. There are also some new tech tools that have been added to the mix of treatments. Many of them are also used in pelvic floor physical therapy.
people are being a little bit more open about the fact that they're having trouble either with incontinence or even pelvic pain.
Amy Diaz is my physical therapist. She's a faculty member at the University of Southern California, Division of Biokinesiology and Physical Therapy. She also leaks urine herself. Her incontinence is from organ prolapse related to pregnancy.
Certainly, I understand the emotional side of it. I understand some of the physical symptoms.
And she's up on the latest technologies to help her patients.
So kegelme.com. Have you seen this, the Kegel? So this is basically a interactive Kegel exerciser that can send information to your smartphone.
A Kegel is an exercise where you tighten your vagina and butt like you're stopping pee midstream. They don't take a ton of effort, but Diaz says many women don't know how to do them correctly. And that's where this device and others like it can help.
Can you describe what that looks like?
Oh, sure. So,
Just describe it.
So it looks a little bit like a dildo that you're going to insert. So as you tighten the muscles, it will cause the device to vibrate.
And all the data pop up on your smartphone via Bluetooth. But you don't have to buy a device that looks like a sex toy. There are tons of apps out there for tracking your pad usage and leaking, or reminding you to pee more frequently, or coaching you through exercises. This one is called Kegel Nation.
Contract your pelvic floor muscles and maintain them as tight as you can for as long as you can.
Thank you, Kegel Coach Meditation Man. I wonder how many of us are clenching our vaginas and butts at this exact moment.
Keep them tight, 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 tight.
Physical therapy and strengthening exercises can work. And there are other treatments too, like injecting Botox into the bladder to stop spasms, or inserting bulking agents into the urethra to beef it up.
Our field is changing rapidly, and I think that's what's fun about it. And from a prognosis perspective, I think we're only going to get better at treating these things.
Right. The new advances are exciting, but they're not going to cure everyone.
I run from, I'm in the pool. Sometimes I don't make it. Stand on the grass.
Take my friend Donna Miro. She is 70 years old and has two kinds of incontinence. She had surgery to install a big supportive mesh sling under her weakened pelvic floor muscles. That was to treat her stress incontinence, and the surgery worked. But she still has memorized the location of every McDonald's off of LA's East-West 10 freeway.
Because they're designed the same, and I know when you go in, you turn right, and there's a bathroom.
That's because her urge incontinence, where she suddenly has to go right now, is still a big problem, in spite of some pretty advanced technology. She had a small device surgically implanted in her back. It gives a little bzzz when her bladder is full, so her brain gets the signal, and she knows it's time to find a toilet. But she still soaks through 3 or 4 pads a day.
Okay. Here's a thick, thick pad.
Donna's urogynecologist says her only option may be more surgery.
I'm not willing to go through any really major surgery to correct this because there's no guarantee. And this is the best that anyone can do. And maybe science and technology will come up with something different.
Studies suggest that the number of American women with urinary incontinence will increase by 55% in the next 35 years due to an aging and increasingly overweight population. So innovators have their work cut out for them. But there is this new product on the market. It's for stress incontinence, so it won't help Donna, but it could help me get back to running. It looks like a tampon, but it's made out of silicone. It's called the Poise Impressa Bladder Support. It's inserted into the vagina and holds the urethra in place so it doesn't leak pee. Dr. Rosenman says it could be a game changer for women with severe stress incontinence because even though strengthening exercises are great for mild cases, she says the only fix for terrible leaking is still surgery. The Impressa could be an alternative, and you can get it at the grocery store. Look, I don't want to leak pee, but I'm glad I'm leaking at this point in history. We have experts and inserts and apps. People are inventing stuff. We pants peers have options. Now, I gotta go. I'm Lauren Whaley.
That story's part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Writer Star Finch was born and raised in San Francisco, so she's seen a lot of changes in her hometown over the years. Those changes and her concerns about them show up in her work as a playwright and author. Her new show, Home, Hookers on Mars Eventually, is running now in San Francisco in a production by Campo Santo. The play brings us to a not-so-distant future where Google elites have colonized Mars, leaving the already marginalized citizens of the Bay Area to struggle on an increasingly damaged planet. Star Finch spoke with KALW's Jen Chien about her vision for humanity in the age of hyper-technology.
This is the first full-length play of yours that's been produced on stage, right?
Yes.
Congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
And full disclosure, we should get this out of the way, that my husband, Sean San Jose, is directing the play.
So he
is. Congratulations on that, I guess.
Definitely.
So tell me about this title, first of all. The title of the play is Home, mm-hmm. Hookers on Mars Eventually. This is intriguing. It's titillating. But it's also pretty accurate to what the play is actually about.
Yes.
So tell me about what happens in the show.
Well, the play is about a sex worker named Chima, and she feels like it's her mission to reunite with the child that she abandoned when she was a teenager. In her mind, his 20th birthday is a rebirth, and it's the perfect time to get to him and tell him her story, you know, tell him his story. The only thing is that he is on Mars with her sister who works for Google. Uh-huh. And so the play tracks sort of her process of getting ready to upload to Mars while she's in Oakland. And it also tracks her son Sante's own adventures on Mars, sort of not knowing that his mother is coming. The play was originally inspired by a photo that I saw, and of course I'm blanking on the photographer, but it is a photographer who is spending time in Hunts Point in the Bronx, and it's an area that's known for prostitution, and he had brought out a giant telescope, and so the shot was of these two prostitutes who are looking at Jupiter through this huge telescope and sort of their body language, and it just really stuck with me, and it got me thinking about, like, who was going to be able to space travel to these new planets. And also, in conjunction with that, the play is really meditating on what has it meant to be a woman on Earth thus far, and how will that translate or not translate into this new world of Mars that everyone seems so intent on getting there and, you know, starting a new world there, and what will that mean for women? Women's bodies, the way that women's bodies have been seen and used on Earth, and as the push for, you know, the people sort of in control of technology and development seem to think that our human evolution is to merge with machines and merge with technology.
The singularity.
Exactly. Uh-huh. How will that affect our ideas of womanhood and what it means to be a woman when so much of the female body has been about labor, you know, in one form of an or another.
Uh-huh. And one of the themes of the show, or maybe an underlying theme, is gentrification or colonization. So
yes.
In the near future world of your play, Google has colonized Mars. And there's a quote from one of the characters when she's asked how the air is up there on Mars. She says, "Air is like Wi-Fi. It's something you have to log on to access. Mm-hmm. If your energy battery is low or you go out of range, you're done." So can you just talk about how you're translating concerns about our everyday world into the fictional world of the play? Because that quote struck me as also being able to be said or applied to today.
Exactly.
And to certain neighborhoods in our cities right now.
Yes. The home part is also about feeling the very cold, hard reality of gentrification in San Francisco and wondering the attitudes of who gets to live here now and sort of who works in tech and how that will translate into who gets to live in these new worlds that the push is to, you know, space travel and who will get to go. Mars is actually colonized by numerous corporations. Corporations are sort of the new citizenship. And this sort of fear of mine that there's just no space for everyday people to exist, you know, like the homeless problem in San Francisco is, I don't even know the word to describe it anymore. And so the feeling of like, if you don't have money or if you're not plugged in, you can't exist anymore. You're sort of swept out of the way or erased, like your humanity is sort of erased, like you don't have a place in San Francisco anymore if you don't have the money to live here. And so I'm thinking a lot about the ways that even water, you know, is like not even considered a right. Like there's this whole push to privatize and phones, you know, Wi-Fi and cell phones. It's like it's a whole world. It's like this world above the world. So if you can't afford a smartphone or if you don't have a computer or Wi-Fi, you're pretty much
you're shut out of that whole world.
Yeah, you know. And so it's the same thing of like, isn't Wi-Fi like air at this point? Like, shouldn't it be free? Like, shouldn't a city like San Francisco or any big city really have free Wi-Fi? Like, shouldn't it be available to everyone? And it's almost like I'm waiting for them to say air costs this much a month, you know, and water and Wi-Fi. I feel like there's certain things that it's like capitalism has made everything a commodity, but it's like as human beings, like as people born onto this planet, don't we have rights to exist, to survive, to thrive, you know, and how do you put a price on those things?
That was KALW's Jen Chien talking to playwright Star Finch. Finch's play, Home, Hookers on Mars Eventually, is running in San Francisco through Sunday. All the details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The California ballot will be crowded this November. Last week, the Secretary of State put out a list of the official initiatives. All 17 of them will be voting on everything from requiring condoms in pornography to repealing the death penalty. This path from policy idea to petition to ballot box is long, and it's very expensive, especially this year. KLW's Angela Johnston tells us why.
There will be almost twice as many initiatives on the ballot this year than in the last presidential election in 2012. Part of the reason for this increase is because the bar to qualify is lower. The number of signatures you need to get your measure on the ballot is based on 5% of the number of people who voted in the last governor's race. So fewer votes means fewer signatures.
So because Jerry Brown was a shoo-in for re-election and no one voted, this was historically low numbers. So everybody looked around and thought, oh my God, historically low, we can all qualify.
Quentin Mecki was one of those people. He manages a campaign called the Justice That Works Act. They want to repeal the death penalty. This year, they only needed around 365,000 signatures to qualify, compared to over 500,000 in 2012.
Looked at the numbers, took some polls. The numbers came back very favorably. Did some analysis with a political consultant and thought, this seems like a great opportunity to do this.
But of course, because the numbers were so low, everyone else saw that same opportunity. Interest groups flooded the market with petitions, and that created a weird paradox. Even though they needed fewer signatures, each one cost a lot more to get.
So it sounds as if it's a volunteer process, right? Everyone's out there on the streets and they're fanning out across the state. It's actually not how the process works at all.
Most signature gathering is organized by a handful of firms that campaigns can hire. And they bring in independent contractors from all over the country who spread out across the state and in front of Trader Joe's or at the farmer's market and ask you if you're a registered voter. Each time they get someone to sign, they get paid. Signature gathering in California has become an industry, but it didn't start out this way.
Initiative process is really essentially one element of direct democracy.
Jack Citrin teaches American politics at UC Berkeley and specifically looks at the ballot initiative process. That process started in the early 20th century as part of the progressive movement.
That enabled voters to directly pass laws, to directly amend the Constitution, and to directly recall elected officials.
It began as a grassroots effort where ordinary people who had an idea to fix a problem would collect enough signatures to qualify something for the ballot. Simple as that. Even when campaigns started paying for signature gathering in the late 70s and 80s, they didn't pay too much.
50 cents, a quarter, then it crept up to $1, $1.50.
But as California's population grew and more people voted in elections, campaigns needed to collect more and more signatures. And at some point, paying other people to do it was just more efficient.
So in some ways, a more economical thing. It's pretty hard to sort of round up armies of people who are really enthusiastic and committed and who are going to go door to door and do this stuff.
Those people you've been seeing in front of Trader Joe's this year are getting $4 to $7 a signature. It's unprecedented.
You have to get 800,000 signatures at $4 a signature. That's $3 million right there just to start.
Plus, most campaigns collect way more signatures than they'll ultimately need.
A lot of the signatures you collect aren't qualified.
People may put down their old address or aren't registered to vote. Quentin Mecki from the Death Penalty Campaign says they got close to twice as many signatures as they needed.
Everyone has different math, right? So technically, we need certified 365,000. By our estimates, we thought the safest number would be to submit around 600,000.
Campaigns aren't just paying for attention from the signature gathering firms. They're also paying for the attention of those Trader Joe's shoppers. Typically, firms are responsible for a handful of initiatives that they're all promoting at the same time. The more you pay, the closer to the top of the stack you get.
So the first question they ask is not, do you support minimum wages? Do you want to end the death penalty? And so that's sort of where the pricing process comes in.
Mecki says there is a thing called petition fatigue, and you don't want your measure to be explained second or third or fourth or fifth. If your measure sounds boring or complex, you may have to pay even more to get the signature gatherers to give it more attention. The Justice That Works Act spent a lot of time crafting a short summary of their measure and turned in their signatures to the Secretary of State at the end of April.
We initially, we probably spent twice what we thought we were going to spend on the signatures. So we didn't expect that this would happen, that it would be so expensive. I'm not sure any of the people did.
They spent close to $3.5 million. And if that seems like a lot, it's nowhere near what's coming next for Mecki. Once the signatures are verified by every single California county and the ballot measure is approved, then comes the actual campaigning. And this year, there's a competing measure on the ballot, one that would streamline the death penalty.
Yeah, we estimate that we need to raise probably an additional $10 million for a successful campaign.
California, he says, is a really big state. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
So now we want to hear from you. If you could put any question on the ballot, a yes or no question, what would it be and why?
Call us with your ideas at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Leave a message and we may get your ballot question on the air. Extra points for creativity. Our creative team that made this show includes Jürgen Klemm, Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Meredith Hoddenott, Ted Muldoon, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Jordan Winters. Our show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Kathy Lemons. She's been part of the Bay Area blues scene since the 80s. You can hear Kathy Lemons at The Saloon on Grant Street in San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood on Thursday night. And before we go, we'd like to wish a happy Eid al-Fitr to the Bay Area Muslim community. The end of Ramadan is here. Eat, drink, and be merry. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Circle round and round, won't let me go, won't set me free. He walk on one toe, and he might as well use a cane. He walk on one toe.